On this week's 51%, a filmmaker has a documentary about women facing cyber harassment.
How do you depict online harassment, and how do you do it in a way that will challenge this attitude that, oh, it's just the internet, or it's just a normal part of life online?
We meet a 12-year-old who is working on testing water for lead and hear from a pipa player. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The new documentary film Netizens exposes the proliferation of cyber harassment faced by women, spreading from the web to the most intimate corners of their lives. As the internet becomes the next frontier of civil rights, this feature documentary follows three women who are targets of harassment, along with advocates, legal experts, and others, as they confront digital abuse and strive for equality and justice online. Cynthia Lowen is an award-winning filmmaker and writer, and is director and producer of Netizens, and she spoke with 51%'s Sarah LaDuke.
So tell me how you decided to make a film about this topic, and then found the subjects that you follow throughout the feature.
I have this very specific memory of getting ready for work in the fall of 2014, and it was around the time when there were several high-profile cases of women in the gaming industry who were being targeted online by these coordinated online mobs. I produced and wrote a film called Bully, which had come out a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of that phase of being like, okay, what's the next project going to be? And hearing these stories and hearing that there seemed to be really no recourse, that law enforcement was not taking these cases seriously, that the site operators seemed to not be providing adequate protections, I felt that there was an opportunity here to tell the stories of these women in a way that could potentially really shift the needle on this issue and highlight what was happening for so many women. So I remember having that moment of just realizing, I think this is the next film. I think this is it. So once I realized that this was the film that I felt like I really wanted and needed to make, there was a long road to figuring out exactly who was going to be in it. And the first thing that I did was I started calling attorneys, because I figured they would be the people who would know who have cases, who's being targeted in this way. And what I discovered is that there are actually very few attorneys who are taking these cases in the United States for a whole range of reasons. One, because the law is often very weak. Prosecutors aren't prosecuting the cases. There's not a lot of support from law enforcement. So there's kind of a handful of attorneys working on these cases. And everyone was like, you have to talk to Carrie Goldberg. And I was in Brooklyn at the time, and she was in Brooklyn. I was like, great. So I biked over. And as soon as I met her, I just knew that I wanted to film with her. And she revealed at that time that although she had just started her own law practice dealing with sexual assault and online harassment, that it had come out of her own experiences and that she was ready to talk about it. So that was where the kind of journey with her began. I met Tina Riney, who I also began filming with early on in the process, through an organization called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. There are so few advocacy organizations that help people who are being targeted for harassment. They're one of the only ones. And when I called them, they said, we have been in touch with someone who we think might be open to talking to you. So Tina was really at the beginning of even knowing that this is a thing, that people are going through it, that she's not the only one. And of course, Anita Sarkeesian was one of the women in that radio story I'd heard early one morning about women who were being targeted and who had to leave their homes because of really violent threats to their personal safety. And so I contacted her a bit later in the process. And for her, you know, she at first was wondering what will be different about this project than the media that's already been done about her case, because there had been so many stories about the bomb threats and the death threats, and a lot of them were really sensational. And for her, she felt that it was really the day-to-day grind of kind of the low-level, just constant barrage of hate messages and response videos that intended to undermine her work and those kinds of attacks were the things that made it really hard to just continue doing her work. And so what I decided to do with her was to really focus on, and for all of the women, focus on the ways that they were really persisting to get their stories out there and to transform their communities as a result of their own experiences.
Anita says in your film that in being harassed so often and having to be worried so much, you lose your own humanity because you can't kid around and you can't relax. And it's so upsetting. So there are people, mostly women, not exclusively, but of course, majority women, who receive this kind of harassment online. And it's grotesque and aggressive, and one can't imagine how bad it is. Then there are people who commit the harassment. And then there's probably, I mean, population-wise, a majority of people who don't witness it from either side. And then, like I just said, can't understand how terrible it is. And there's an inclination, I think, to go, well, how bad could it be? Mm-hmm. Somebody's just tweeting at you, like, block them. Why does that bother you so much? But it is a threat on your space and person. Did you want to show in your movie the level of harassment to people who haven't witnessed it?
Absolutely. I think that was one of my biggest goals and challenges with the film, is this question, how do you depict online harassment? And how do you do it in a way that will challenge this attitude that, oh, it's just the internet, or it's just a normal part of life online, or if you don't like it, why don't you just turn off your computer? And so my approach to the film was to really follow the women who are in the film for a period of about 2 years and to intimately depict how every aspect of their life is affected by the harassment, their personal safety, their ability to get a job, their ability to get an education, even simple things like going on a date. You know, people Google you if you have a digital footprint that has been totally vandalized by somebody. It's going to impact everything in your life. And it doesn't matter if you're online or offline. If you're trying to get a job, people are still going to see those things. The other thing that I felt like I was hearing a lot is that, you know, these aren't just attitudes that people who perhaps haven't experienced harassment feel or have. They're attitudes that law enforcement has. And that is super problematic if you're somebody who is being harassed and whose safety is being threatened. For example, there's a young woman in the film who's being advertised for dates and intimate encounters on Craigslist.
And she doesn't know who's doing it.
Yeah, and she doesn't know who's placing these ads. She's not placing the ads. And the perpetrator is responding to the ads and impersonating her and setting up rendezvous at her place of work and at her home. So she has dozens of men showing up at her home and her office, and it's a really dangerous situation. And yet when she attempted to get law enforcement to intervene, their response was, you know, just turn off your computer. That was really the central challenge with this film, was how do you depict it in a way that will really challenge this attitude that this is just a normal part of life online. It's not a big deal. The victims should change their, you know, daily interactions with the internet, or they should, you know, change their lives to accommodate the perpetrators. You know, that was a response that I felt like was not acceptable.
When did you begin making the film?
So I started doing research in the fall of 2014 and started filming in May of 2015.
When did you stop filming?
December of 2017.
Okay. So Donald Trump gets elected while you're making the movie. Access Hollywood tape comes out while you're making the movie. Me Too and Weinstein starts while you're making the movie. What has all of that meant? Is there a marked improvement or decline in light of what has happened over the last few years in terms of misogyny, women's empowerment, harassment, bullying online, etc.?
There were so many surprises along the way of making this film. And of course, the outpouring of women sharing their experiences on the internet through the Me Too movement, I think, was this incredible demonstration of what women's voices can do online to shift our culture, to shift our society, to change our workplaces and our schools and our communities. And it was kind of this perfect encapsulation of why it matters that women are able to be online and participate online and the potential of those voices. At the same time, Donald Trump, as you said, has come into office. And this is somebody who has really used the internet in a way to foment coordinated online mobs to target people, and who is habitually abusive in the way that he comports himself on the internet. And so on the flip side, I think that has done a lot of damage to normalize this really abusive discourse and to educate a lot of people who may not have otherwise known, how can I foment a coordinated online mob? We now have someone who's setting an example for all these people on how do you use the internet to really target people.
Your last film, Bully, was released by the Weinstein Company.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like or is like in light of the revelations of his stuff? Like, do you have any problems with him? Did you deal with Harvey Weinstein directly or no?
I did deal with Harvey Weinstein directly and found him to be an incredibly intimidating person. And I can only imagine how frightening it must have been for the women that he targeted. The great irony of him having put out Bully has not been lost on anyone on the team. It's kind of this crazy full circle experience in that Carrie Goldberg, who's one of the central three women in Netizens.
Right. The attorney who is working on these issues, who created a firm when she needed a lawyer for this but couldn't find one, and so made a firm that will work on only these kinds of things.
Yeah, and she's now representing several women who are at the center of the cases against Harvey Weinstein. So it's a crazy time. And it is incredible to see this reckoning happening.
That was filmmaker Cynthia Lowen discussing her documentary Netizens, for which she is director and producer. She was speaking with 51%'s Sarah LaDuke. The discovery of lead in drinking water systems in Flint, Michigan, and other cities around the country has motivated researchers to find new and faster ways to detect contamination in water supplies. One scientist who recently invented a way to rapidly test for lead in water developed her award-winning solution between swim team practice and piano lessons. H2O Radio reports.
The Flint water crisis that started in 2014 brought the problem of lead contamination to the attention of the nation. Since that time, numerous school systems across the country have found lead in their systems, and people in Flint still don't trust that their water is safe, even though some government officials say it is. A person in the Denver area has been working on lead contamination since she first heard about it, but she's not a professor at a university yet, and she has no degree yet.
I heard about the water crisis in Flint about 3 years ago, and I realized that it was a big problem.
That's 12-year-old Geetanjali Rao, who has invented a device to rapidly detect lead in water. We met with her in what she calls her science room at her home.
It was just a question of why is this happening? Because a lot of children my age were drinking water and using it as a natural resource, which we all take advantage of, and are getting poisoned by it, and that just didn't seem right.
The idea of how to test for lead came to Geetanjali while she was doing what few of us do, regardless of age, reading articles in the MIT News Journal about its latest research.
They were using carbon nanotube sensors to detect hazardous gases in the air. And that's when I connected this idea back to the Flint water crisis, and I wanted to expand that idea to apply for liquids as well to detect lead in drinking water.
So what are carbon nanotubes?
So what it is it's essentially like a tube, but they'll make hexagonal patterns with carbon structure or carbon ions. So it's like a tube, but it's kind of like a beehive around it.
The nanotubes are very small, about 1/1,000,000th of a meter. She installed them in her tester, which she can hold in her hand. When in contact with water, the nanotubes detect lead because it sticks to carbon or chloride ions, creating a sort of speed bump that interferes with a current. Her device then sends the information to a smartphone app, an app that Geetanjali developed herself. Did you write the program for the device to speak to the app?
Yeah, I did write the program for everything.
Geetanjali learned programming starting when she was about 6 or 7 years old from her parents, who both work in technology. Her lead detector, which she calls Tethys, for the Greek goddess of fresh water, is so promising that she has been working to perfect it with Denver Water, the largest provider in Colorado.
Geetanjali's invention is a very good tool for the community, right? Not just in Denver, but in many places of the United States and in the world.
That's Selena Hernandez-Ruiz, who is the lab manager for Denver Water. She holds a PhD from the University of Arizona in environmental chemistry and has been working with Geetanjali. Dr. Hernandez-Ruiz explained that providers, like Denver Water, are required to use certain instruments and tests to assure that lead and other contaminants aren't in their system. But those processes take time, and the beauty of Geetanjali's device is that homeowners or even schools could use it to quickly assess if they need further testing. So how was it to work with Geetanjali?
She is an amazing scientist, I have to say that. Whenever she comes into the laboratory and we get on the board or we start working on the bench, it's like you're interacting with somebody at a college level of education or somebody that has been working in a laboratory for a while. She's very mature.
Geetanjali is now back in school after a summer of swim team practices, hanging out with friends, and even doing some baking in the kitchen. But she continues to work on her invention.
I think that my device can be commercially feasible. I want to make 50 prototypes of it and send them out to residents of Flint and see how it goes there. And depending on that, I want to see if I could take it to market.
But even if the market doesn't reward her, others already have. Last year, she was named America's top young scientist by Discovery Education and the 3M Corporation. And recently, on September 21st, she was awarded the President's Environmental Youth Award from the EPA. As one might guess, there's a whole lot more in Geetanjali's future, but all of it may or may not have to do with water.
And you want to go to MIT, right?
I do, yeah. I have a huge interest in going to MIT. I'm such a big fan. I want to study genetics and epidemiology. So.
And if all that doesn't work out, Geetanjali could easily think about being a concert pianist. As we left her science room, she played a piece for us by her favorite composer, Chopin. To see pictures of her lead-sensing device, Tethys, go to our website, h2oradio.org. From Denver, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Girls get slightly higher grades in science and math worldwide than boys, but fewer enter STEM professions.
Debunking STEM gender myths. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. Fewer women than men are employed in science, engineering, and math fields. But that's not due to differences in academic achievement, according to a study in Nature Communications. University of New South Wales researcher Rose O'Day and her team analyzed the academic performance of 1.6 million students worldwide and found that girls received slightly higher average grades in STEM than boys.
Our study suggests that there are enough talented girls to feed into this STEM pipeline and to shrink this gender gap in science and maths, but just that this talent pool is being underutilized.
O'Day's team also found that boys' overall performance was more variable than girls, but more so in non-STEM fields like reading and writing.
So rather than worrying about improving girls' math skills, maybe we should be worrying about improving boys' language skills.
I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
When the Minnesota Timberwolves asked Gao Hong to play the Star-Spangled Banner before a game, she was nervous. This would be the first time most fans had heard her, or anyone for that matter, play the Chinese pipa, and she wanted them to love it. KFAI's Ryan Dawes reports.
In Northfield, Minnesota, I'm Ryan Dawes. From Jimi Hendrix, Wailing at Woodstock, to Roseanne Barr, squawking at a baseball game. We've heard some wild versions of our national anthem. And yet, who selected to perform the anthem can still surprise us.
Joining us for tonight's national anthem, originally from Beijing, and a world-class performer on the traditional Chinese pipa, please welcome Gao Hong.
Gao Hong heads up the Chinese music program at Carleton College. In 2017, she was invited to perform the anthem at a Minnesota Timberwolves game. When the Wolves first approached her, she was worried they wanted her to sing, because, like Roseanne, Gao Hong isn't much of a vocalist.
The reason I played the pipa was because my mom said every time I sing, it's like somebody step on the rooster neck.
The pipa is a large pear-shaped Chinese lute that dates back about 2,000 years. Instead of strumming it like a guitar, the pipa is played by flicking the strings with the tops of your fingers.
And we have five fake nails.
Yes, you need fake fingernails to play the pipa.
So the reason is that because this four strings made of metal right now. Long time ago made of silk or guts.
The metal strings are too harsh for natural nails, so pipa players opt for plastic ones, which they secure to their fingers with medical tape. Two of these nails are especially important to Gao Hong.
You can see the differences. This pinky and this ring finger has a much, much smaller one, little yellowish. And I gotta tell you the history. I've been playing the pipa for 46 years. This the original.
She's had those two same nails since she was 8.
But it's kind of a good luck for me, so I always keep this too.
Gao Hong plays traditional pipa compositions as well as new music, collaborating across cultures and genres. She plays bluegrass, she plays with musicians from the Middle East, and here she plays with a pair of musicians from India. So the U.S. national anthem should be no big deal, right?
Pipa just a solo instrument. I just thought it was crazy.
With an average attendance of 17,000 at Timberwolves games, Gao Hong knew she had to bring it.
So if I, example, if I just play... Nobody want to hear that. You know, I was thinking, what I can do to make everybody excited. So I just like... I've been in America for 24 years and always watching people playing the national anthem. I always, in my heart, I was thinking that's only can be the American people will do. For me, I think at least they know there is Chinese pipa can play the national anthem, can be powerful. I really think it's a really wonderful way to introduce the Chinese pipa.
For KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1528.